I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Lynn Julius, author of Uprooted, How 3,000 Years of Jewish Civilization in the Arab World Vanished Overnight. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. There are so many different areas of Jewish educational experience available for adults, from studying Torah to learning Talmud to exploring Kabbalah to delving into Jewish history. All these Judaic disciplines provide fertile ground for personal growth and ethical development. But perhaps the most interesting among them is the unusual process of learning and teaching Musar, Jewish ethical development and personal growth. I've begun team teaching a Musar group the last couple of weeks. Unlike most other Jewish learning experiences, Musar is not really about top-down instruction. Instead, it requires students and teachers to explore their own personal relationship to a series of midot. That's a difficult word to translate from the Hebrew. It means, in essence, the characteristics or qualities or even moral ideals, sometimes called soul traits in Musar parlance. In a Musar group, you explore each of the various midot with a partner or partners, doing what is called chevruta learning, and then discuss what you discover through that process about your own life and tendencies. Do I conduct my days as though this aspect of morality is important? Am I particularly challenged by this ideal? Does it come easily to me? Does it seem incredibly difficult to incorporate this concept into my daily life? How can I reflect on that and find ways to change for the better? For example, we began this particular Musar group. It is only the second one I've led and participated in. I came to Musar kind of late in my professional life with a class on moderation, the Midah of the Shvil Zahav, the golden mean. I definitely find moderation to be a personal challenge at times. Just one more helping of cake or another ice cream bar, 5 more miles on my bike, buy a slightly better seat for a show or a ball game, push to get just a little more done. It's fascinating to discuss how challenging moderation can be with other people who may or may not be like you, have quite different personalities. See how they listen to your challenges and reflect in their own ways on this Jewish spiritual tradition of cultivating self-awareness. The second midah we addressed in this class, the second ideal trait we explored, was humility. I was surprised to find that everybody, including individuals I consider to be pretty darned humble, found that they were challenged to be humble in their own lives. It was a vital and engaged discussion of both the Jewish concepts of humility and the limits and balance between humility and self-worth, a rich area for personal growth. Musar is unique. It's not psychology or therapy, although it's related in a way. You have to think about why and how you do the things you do, whether they are valuable or damaging. And as always in any serious and studious engagement, Musar illustrates that there must be a balance between ideals. As we taught in this class on moderation last week, moderation in all things, including moderation. This discipline of Musar, this particular area of Jewish spiritual study and practice, goes back all the way to the Middle Ages, but it reached a high point in the late 19th century in certain European yeshivot academies. It has been revived in the last 25 years or so as a contemporary means of transformative personal growth. It's a powerful and enjoyable way to deepen Jewish knowledge and experience in meaningful ways. and it's a lot of fun to learn and teach. My favorite two quotes on humility from our last Musar class came from a non-Jewish source, Sir Winston Churchill. They are kind of self-contradictory, but illuminating nonetheless. The first quote was from Churchill about Clement Attlee, his successor as Prime Minister after World War II. "A modest little person with much to be modest about." But then Churchill also said, "In the course of my life, I have often had to eat my words. I must confess, I have always found it a wholesome diet." Yeah, eating your own words. Good way to grow. Great stuff to remember when we're feeling a little bit too full of ourselves and perhaps forgetting the words of the prophet Micah. "What does the Lord require of you? Only to do justice, to love goodness, and to walk humbly with your God." Great words to live by. To play us in this morning, we have a song from the influential Israeli pop superstar Tzvika Pick, who died last week. It's his hit love song, Elef Neshikot, A Thousand Kisses.
Neshika Rishona Al Mitzchech Halavan Kemo Kesher Be'emza Dmutech U'mimena Yetzlu Be'shifat Zohoran Neshikot, Neshikot Vishareh Koteret Pninim Asuya Min Shikot Al Shchol Taltalai Champi שתהיני ילדה היפה בצליחות המושלמת בכל בנות העיר. אלף נשיקות לך אהובתי, אלף נשיקה ונשיקה, אלף נשיקות לך חמודתי היפה הקטנה המתוקה. אלף נשיקות לך אהובתי, אלף נשיקה ונשיקה, אלף נשיקות לך חמודתי היפה הקטנה המתוקה. וגם את צווארך השלגי הבתולי, הגמיש כצוואר הברבור, החסה בנשיקות מחרוסות מחרוסות, ילדת מים קטנטונת שלי. ואתה סומסים את ראשי על כתפך ולמצוא בו את דופק הלב. וגם סתם נשיקות בלי תאווה ובכלל, פרחים ושלחים על קלה. אלף נשיקות לך אהובתי, אלף נשיקה ונשיקה, אלף נשיקות לך חמודתי היפה הקטנה המתוקה. אלף נשיקות.
That was Tzvika Pick, who recently passed away. His Israeli hit, Elef Neshikot, A Thousand Kisses. Our guest this morning, Lynn Julius, is an expert on the Jews of the Arab world, author of Uprooted, How 3,000 Years of Jewish Civilization in the Arab World Vanished Overnight. Meet her and find out about this important and shockingly neglected story of a Jewish exodus, a modern one, indeed the expulsion of the Jews of the Arab world, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson, enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, visiting us from the United Kingdom. Lynn Julius is an expert on the Sephardic world, and in particular, the world of the Jews of the Arab lands and countries. Her book, an extraordinary book, Uprooted, How 3,000 Years of Jewish Civilization in the Arab World Vanished Overnight, is terrific and well worth reading. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about how you got involved in exploring the Jewish civilization of the Arab countries.
Well, there were two main reasons. One is my own family background, which is that I am the daughter of Jews from Iraq, Jewish refugees, actually, who were forced to leave in 1950. And the other reason is because there is so little information about this subject. So basically, it grew out of a blog, which I update every day, called Point of No Return, and which you're welcome to subscribe to or to visit. All you have to do is Google Point of No Return blog, and you get to it.
So coming from, you know, the Jews of Iraq, that's a Jewish community that goes back well over 2,600 years, might be as much as 2,700 or 2,800 years, that an incredible Jewish civilization, the source eventually of the Babylonian Talmud. There were many Jews living in Iraq up until 1948. Tell us a little bit about their story.
Yes, that's correct. There were perhaps 150,000 Jews in Iraq. Of course, they don't call themselves the Iraqi Jews. They call themselves the Babylonian.
Babylonian Jews, right.
Yes, that's right, because they go back, as you say, 2,600 years or more. They were a glorious community. They contributed the Babylonian Talmud to Judaism, they were a great source of intellectual and spiritual inspiration, I'd say, to Judaism. They had the ups and downs over history. There were successive conquerors who took over the area. Under Islam, the Jews did have their golden age under the Abbasids. But they were basically second-class citizens under Islam as dhimmis.
Dhimmi, right. And that, nonetheless, second-class citizens, it was a thriving and important Jewish community. There were great Iraqi writers and so on. Once Israel became a reality, all of that changed dramatically.
Well, I would say that the changes occurred before Israel came into being. The colonial era, which lasted really under the British mandate, that was the early 20th century, that was the Jewish golden age. And the Jews had a finance minister who was Jewish. The trade and commerce and banking and all fields, loads of fields were actually dominated by Jews, and it was a great time. But all this began to change in the 1930s with the rise of Arab nationalism. Much of it Nazi inspired, actually, and Nazi influence began to penetrate the country. Jews were actually dismissed from their jobs in the 1930s. And then all this culminated in a terrible episode, which was a massacre in 1941, inspired by the pro-Nazi Mufti of Jerusalem, who happened to be living in Baghdad between 1939 and 1941. This massacre was called the Farhud, and the Jewish community had never known anything like it in living memory. Over 2 days, a mob rampaged through the Jewish quarter, through Baghdad, killing Jews, looting and raping, and it was a traumatic episode. And I would say that within 10 years, the community, most of the community had left. With the rise of, with the establishment of Israel and the war declared by the Arab League against Israel, the regime in Iraq began to persecute the Jews, treat them as enemy aliens, if you like, to steal their property and try and pay for the war against Israel with their assets. And the situation was untenable. Most of all, the Jews did fear another Farhud, another massacre. And therefore, when given an opportunity to leave the country, 99% of the community decided to go.
We will talk much more with Lynn Julius about the Jews of Arab lands and the great exodus that took place. Her book is called Uprooted, How 3,000 Years of Jewish Civilization in the Arab World Vanished Overnight. We'll come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy classes and schools, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school begins this morning for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our wonderful Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs in a wonderful, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. for services. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., services at 10 a.m. You can also email me directly, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or join us each Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are in blended format, live and on Zoom. Access those through the website, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too. Some students coming in person, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, the upcoming High Holy Days, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook Live, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing congregation in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store or Podbean as very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean, and now available on Spotify, too. Post a rating and review to Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. All those comments really help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And shockingly, Tom, you're just back from a trip. That never happens, of course. You were in the south of France, which has really an ancient Jewish community, very interesting one. Tell us about some of your experiences, if you would.
Well, so this actually is shocking because it was my first trip out of the country since before COVID, since 2019.
Right.
And I went first to Israel as my first destination, and then to the south of France, where I met two friends, and we hung out in a region where I had lived and worked for several months back in like 1985 or something, very long ago.
Long ago in a different world,
as a lifetime away.
Yep.
So the region is much more crowded now, but it was also a papal enclave. It was a papal state. So the Jews who lived there were called the Pope's Jews, and different regulations applied to them from those that applied to Jews living in actual France. This was not French territory, although it was surrounded by France, and there's lots of military architecture to attest to this difference and to the friction between the French king and the popes who ruled over this enclave from the papal palace in Avignon, which is in this enclave and where the popes lived for 100 years.
Right.
Basically, rough, if you round off, the whole 14th century.
1300s, and there was a schism in the midst of it and a lot of stuff. Okay, so not far from Avignon.
So there are two communities that have extant synagogues. One is called Carpentras, and the other is called Cavaillon. We actually stayed in Cavaillon for an entire week, so we had ample time to inform ourselves as to when the synagogue might be open for visits and the fact that you needed to have a guide, you couldn't just walk in, and lots of other restrictive things. But it's open 7 days a week except for Saturday, big shocker there, and Tuesday at random. And I'll come back to that synagogue in Cavaillon in a minute because it's worth a long story in and of itself. The one in Carpentras is still theoretically in use. It's not just a museum. And every once in a while, they actually have a minyan, especially if there's some group of traveling Jews to bolster the numbers of local Jews. That synagogue was built in the middle of the 14th century, like 1357 or something. And it was remodeled, renovated, whatever, a couple of times since then. But on the same site, in the heart of Carpentras, in what used to be the Jewish quarter, is this very big structure with lots of visible signs. And one of the visible signs is on the big square in front of the synagogue in Carpentras, it says Place de la Juiverie, the place of the Jews, Jews Plaza.
Yeah, Jews Plaza.
And this is like the 10th time I've tried to get into that synagogue in the past 35 years, and the 10th time I failed. This time it turns out, because I didn't go online at least 3 days in advance and reserve a group tour, which happens either two or three times a day, depending on the day of the week. But you have to visit in a group. And we went on like a Friday morning, And the woman said, if you go online, you might be able to find a place for Tuesday or Wednesday. Well, there are very few visitors who stay that long in Carpentras.
Which, by the way, that is a famous Jewish community. It was very important in the Middle Ages. Sephardic, but in a particular flavor, kind of a southern France.
Right. So, the question about the Jewish communities in this region is, they took on their own character and their own customs in this period when they were a papal state.
Right.
But they were predated by Jewish communities going back to Roman times.
Right.
First, second century of the Common Era, there were Jews there who were obviously not Sephardic because the distinction didn't exist then.
Yet. Yeah, right.
And they certainly didn't come from Spain. Most of the Jews who were there in the 14th, 15th century did come as a result of persecutions or expulsions from other places.
Leaving wars, you know, in the Iberian Peninsula, wherever ended up over there.
And so they had kind of a hybrid between Sephardic traditions and Ashkenazic traditions and Provençal traditions. And the closest thing there is today is the Italian tradition. And we'll come back next week to the experience in Cavaillon.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Businessman Abe Greenberg phones a law office and says, I want to talk to my lawyer. The receptionist replies, I'm sorry, Mr. Greenberg, he died last week. The next day, Abe calls again and asks the same question. I want to talk to my lawyer. The receptionist replies, I told you yesterday, he died last week. On the third day, Greenberg calls again and asks to speak to his lawyer. This time the receptionist, getting a little annoyed, she says, Mr. Greenberg, I keep telling you your lawyer died last week. Why do you keep calling? And Greenberg says, it gives me such pleasure to hear you say that. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Even the lawyers. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, fourth Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of marvelous Torah portions with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole of Torah, Ki yihyev achai avyon me'achad achecha be'achad sharecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother, Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate suffering, but to give them what they actually want, sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our American society, in which the safety net seemingly has as many holes as net. It is more than the social protesters in Israel believe their own society is providing. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand. Surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. That is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power. No one should be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion. Give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and do so in a way that preserves the recipient's dignity. That's the true measure of tzedakah, living justly and in righteousness. Judaism at heart is pragmatic ethics. We are trained to make the world morally better by practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity need to give something to those with less, the rabbis conclude that tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of your income, not a hard figure, and that the same percentage, whether it's 10% or 5% of your gross income or some other number, should be given in good times and bad. Even in crazy, strange, weird times when things seem economically uncertain, like now. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, are preserved. So, my friends, open your hand. Give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously, in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Lynn Julius, who comes from an Iraqi Jewish background, is an author and activist on all things about Jews of the Arab world, will tell us how that world ended, an incredible book she wrote about it, and why it matters and impacts events today and will continue to do so in the future. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An Arab resident of East Jerusalem who brutally shot up a bus turned himself into Israeli police after a manhunt that focused on the Silwan neighborhood. The shooting took place last week in an early morning as people boarded a bus. Among those shot were multiple members of a family from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, a center of the Satmar Hasidic sect of Orthodox Jews, a teenager from a different Brooklyn family, a pair of Israeli brothers, and a pregnant woman who remains hospitalized along with her child, whom doctors delivered after she suffered an injury to her abdomen. The terrorist shooting occurred a week after an exchange of hostilities between Israel and the terrorist group Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza, in which dozens of Palestinians died and nearly 1,000 rockets were fired towards Israel. It also comes after months of relative calm within Israel, after a series of attacks this spring, during which 19 Israelis were murdered. The tourists wounded in the Jerusalem shooting are among a huge wave of visitors flowing into Israel this summer, after years of pandemic travel restrictions tamped down travel. Hours after the attack, Prime Minister Yair Lapid broadcast confidence in Jerusalem. He tweeted a picture of himself eating at a cafe there. "Our capital city is strong, safe, beautiful, and welcomes residents and tourists," Lapid wrote. Also in Israel, Tzvika Pick, the prolific songwriter and musician known as Israel's King of Pop and called the Maestro, died at the age of 72. Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, said Tzvika Pick had breathed new life into Israel's cultural landscape, brought about a revolutionary change to it. His music penetrated our hearts, became an integral part of the soundtrack of our lives. Born in Poland in 1949, Tzvika Pick immigrated to Israel with his parents at a young age. He began by studying classical music at the age of 5. As a teenager, he was the vocalist in several bands. He jump-started his musical career in the 1970s when he landed the lead part in the first Israeli production of the musical Hair. Tzvika Pick released 9 albums in the 70s. His first wife, Mirit Shem-Or, was a close collaborator on many of his hits, including the very popular Mary Lou. Standing out with his flamboyant and androgynous dress sense, you know, a little bit of David Bowie, I guess, and his signature long hair at a time when Israeli performers and audiences were very conservative, Tzvika Pick began writing songs and music for other artists in the 80s and 90s as his own personal popularity faded a bit. He wrote the 1998 Eurovision-winning song Diva with the lyricist Yoav Ginai. Rebecca Pick's daughter Daniela, a successful singer in her own right with her sister and a prominent Israeli model, is married to American director Quentin Tarantino. They have two children, Svika Pick's Jewish grandchildren, and they live in Tel Aviv. When the news of Pick's death broke, Israeli radio stations ended regular programming to just play his music. Svika Pick died today, but the songs and melodies he left behind will continue to be played for many years to come, said Prime Minister Yair Lapid. And again from Israel, Turkey and Israel will return ambassadors to their countries, ending a four-year rupture as each country seeks to expand ties and influence in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid and Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu made the announcement last week after Lapid spoke with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The agreement follows a visit to Ankara in March by Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog, who met with Erdogan. Erdogan initiated the suspension of ties after violence flared on the Israeli-Gaza border following the Trump administration's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem in 2018. Diplomatic ties were previously strained back in 2010, that's 12 years ago now, after Israel's deadly raid on a Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, which tried to break Israel's blockade of Gaza. Israel and Turkey reconciled to a degree in 2016. Israel seeks to build on the 2020 Abraham Accords, which normalized relations with four Arab countries. Turkey wants to be part of Israeli-led plans to explore energy sources in the Mediterranean. Natural gas is prevalent there. And it's also seeking to repair ties with countries in the region unsettled by revolution and repression ever since the explosion of the Arab Spring in the early 2010s. And the lamentable, corrupt, and antique leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, made headlines in Germany for a visit with the leadership there when he said that Israel had perpetrated holocausts against the Palestinians. Mahmoud Abbas is the guy who wrote his PhD dissertation denying the Holocaust. He did so at a Soviet Union university. This should be no surprise from Abbas that he had the chutzpah to make this egregiously false claim in Germany, which is, you know, rather sensitive since it perpetrated the actual Holocaust against the Jews, is perhaps also not surprising if it is disappointing. A guy who denies the Holocaust now claims it has happened multiple times to his own people, who somehow, under the threat of this imminent destruction, have ballooned from about 750,000 in 1948 to a current population of well over 5 million. That is not a Holocaust. It is a population growing exponentially, not being decimated. The truth is, Mahmoud Abbas has been propped up by Israel for decades now, since the younger alternatives to his utterly corrupt Palestinian Authority are Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and even more vicious and dangerous Palestinian terrorist organizations. Nonetheless, Abbas has definitely had the tendency to bite the Israeli hand that feeds him on more than one occasion. Oh, and Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, and the rest of the Palestinian Authority's geriatric leaders all get treated in excellent Israeli hospitals by Jewish doctors when they are seriously ill, of course. Hypocrisy, self-delusion, and propaganda have always been part of the Palestinian Authority's sad and disastrous dead-end approach to pretty much everything. Yep, that should be their theme song, Running on Empty. The Palestinian Authority still running on empty after all these years. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Lynn Julius is an expert about the Jews of Arab lands, the daughter of Iraqi Jewish refugees herself, degree in international relations, a journalist and blogger. Her book is called Uprooted, It's an extraordinary story of the, well, complete end of Jewish civilization in Arab lands in a short period of time. We talked extensively at the beginning of the show about the Iraqi Jewish community. That wasn't a unique experience, though. The anti-Semitism that was spread in Iraq in the Nazi period by the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was actually in the pay of the Nazis, but also as soon as not only in World War, with the end of World War II and the rise of the Jewish state, the development of the State of Israel, Jews in Arab lands were under attack kind of all across the Dar Maghreb, really everywhere. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, that's absolutely right. The Arab League drafted a set of discriminatory laws persecuting their own Jewish citizens, freezing their bank accounts, depriving them of their rights. All the states who were Arab League members, there were seven of them, I think, including Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Iraq, and a few others. They all persecuted their Jews and criminalized Zionism, which meant that any Jew could be arrested, jailed, and even executed on trumped-up charges of being a Zionist. The question was, how do you define Zionism? Jews were arrested, really, for being in possession of letters from Palestine or being in possession of a prayer shawl with a Magen David on it. Any spurious pretext would do. But of course, the Jews became at risk of being scapegoated for the slightest reason as enemies of the state. And their situation became untenable. At the same time, there were outbreaks of violence. Mobs went on the rampage, for instance, in Aden, in Syria, and in Bahrain.
Yeah.
And there were...
I think in Morocco, too, actually.
Yes, that was... It didn't happen, actually, until 1948.
Oh, Morocco,
was it a bit later? I'm thinking okay. In terms of just immediately after the partition plan was passed.
In 47, right. Okay.
But certainly in Morocco, there was a riot in 1948, in June 1948, and 48 Jews died in that incident.
The Jews in these Arab countries had been there in some cases, like the Iraqi Jews, for thousands of years, but well, really in almost all of these countries for as much as 2,000 years and more. Their exodus was almost complete. There are still some very tiny Jewish communities in these Arab countries, but the mass of those Jews left. What could they take with them, and where did they go?
Well, the vast majority left under duress, which meant that they left with very little. Countries like Iraq and Egypt restricted Jews to just £20 or $30 or $40 and one suitcase, something like that. So effectively, the Jews were expelled with very little, leaving all their property behind. And in the vast majority of cases, they were never compensated.
The Jews that came to Israel from Arab lands found a complicated society. You don't address that so much here because it's really the ending of that ancient and rich civilization. And here they came and they had to find a new way in a new land. I think of, they contributed tremendously to Israel, but I think of authors like Sami Michael, who write about this sense of loss that they bring with them. Was that true for your family? Your family was in Britain.
Yes, I think it was very difficult arriving in a strange country, having to adapt to a new culture. Although my parents did speak the language, they had to start from scratch. It was also quite difficult for them to integrate socially. So during my childhood, really, I remember that they mixed with other Iraqi Jews. They didn't really mix with society at large. But they rebuilt their lives successfully, and it was, you know, they resettled, I would say. And the same goes for Jews in Israel. I think despite all the difficulties, and there were huge problems, for instance, the Jews arrived and were put in Ma'barot, which was transit,
right,
made up of tents.
Tents. I mean, if they were lucky, they got caravans. Like, that was a big step up.
That's right. I mean, the tents became sort of tin huts or wooden cabins, and eventually became whole cities, like Sderot, which is the city in the south of Israel, which is often targeted.
And rocket attacks from Gaza, yeah.
Yeah, rocket attacks from Gaza. But there are dozens of cities in Israel that started life as Ma'barot, or tent camps. And Jews from Arab countries found themselves in these camps. There were Jews from Romania, Poland, and even Holocaust survivors who also found themselves in these tent camps. But they tended to manage to leave these camps sooner than Jews from Arab countries.
The experience of leaving everything behind, losing all of your assets, some of these Jews in Arab lands were very successful, financially successful, had been there for a long time, established businesses for generations. It's fascinating that there's a tremendous amount of attention paid to the Palestinians who lost their homes or left their homes in 1947, 1948, but there's been almost no attention paid to the Jews of Arab lands. Can you explain that a little bit?
I think there are various reasons. One was Israel did not make an issue of these Jews. I think because they did not want to drive a wedge between the different ethnic groups arriving in Israel. They wanted these refugees to put the past behind them and to consider themselves as Israeli citizens, speaking Hebrew. And in fairness, a lot of the Jews did not want to look back, because after all, many of them had escaped terrible conditions, riots, violence, imprisonment. You know, it was not pleasant, and they were not in a mood to look back. But what we find is that successive generations have been more interested in exploring their roots. And the grandchildren are now really interested in what life was like back in the Arab countries. And you find musicians who are exploring their heritage and reviving it in some way, or reinventing it. And it's a very interesting phenomenon.
It is.
There's another reason, yeah, another reason perhaps I could mention, and that's the Jews did not want to compare themselves in any way to Holocaust survivors, because after all, they have survived their ordeal, and it would have been invidious to make that comparison, obviously. And so the Israelis also wanted to treat these Jews as Zionists returning to their homeland. They did not want them to be considered refugees. But all this has changed, I would say, in the last 10 years. And a campaign started, that the Israeli government designated a date in the calendar to commemorate the exodus of Jewish refugees from Arab countries and Iran. And there's also a law passed by the Knesset in 2010, which states that no peace agreement can be signed with the Arab states unless compensation is on the table for Jewish refugees from Arab countries.
Some kind of reparation for all that they lost. You founded an organization called Harif. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so Harif has been going for about 16 years. It's the UK Association of Jews from the Middle East and North Africa. We have a website, www.harif.org, and anybody can subscribe to our mailing list. We encourage anybody interested in the history and heritage of Jews from the Middle East and North Africa to join us. We have a regular program of Zoom events, which we started during the coronavirus pandemic. They're called lockdown lectures, and we run them approximately every 2 weeks. And we welcome you all to join us. The lectures do attract an American audience, and we usually go out at about 2:30 New York time on a Tuesday evening, fortnightly. So Arizona time, that would be 3 hours behind that.
Yes, I understand. I want to thank Lynn Julius for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called Uprooted, How, Well, the Incredible Jewish Civilization of Arab Lands Disappeared in Just a Moment. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your book?
Well, I would definitely encourage you to check out the Harif website, which is www.harif.org.
H-A-R-I-F, in case you don't know how to spell.
Yeah, that's right. My book is available on Amazon. It's actually printed in the U.S. as well as in the U.K.
It's a great read, and it's a fascinating and undertold story. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Adam Langer, wonderful novelist, the former senior editor for Culture, and the author of the new novel, Cyclorama. It will be great. I love his books. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person each Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. And the Jewish High Holy Days are coming up just 5 weeks from tonight. You can join us in person or online. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for information on how you can come to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Our playout this morning comes from the late Tzvika Pick, passed away last week. It's his setting of the Shema. It became ubiquitous at Jewish camps and in contemporary services in the 70s, still used today. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Shema Yisrael, Adoshem Elokeinu, Adoshem Echad. Shema Yisrael, Adoshem Elokeinu, Adoshem Echad. Shema Yisrael.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.